Welcome to the JPGM Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
October JPGM Journal Club, led by Dr. Jake Mann. As always, keep in mind ESPGHAN's other educational offerings, to be found at https://www.espghan.org Knowledge Center. There's a hyphen between knowledge and center. In particular, on the 25th of October, a monothematic conference on pediatric gastric disease. On the 11th of November, the Winter School on Basic Science and Translational Research. And on the 15th of November, a masterclass on transition from pediatric to adult healthcare in patients with GI or liver disease. For today's discussion, Jake has chosen a review of a small series of patients from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition by D'Arienzo et al., Characteristics and Outcomes of Home Parenteral Nutrition Among Children with Severe Neurological Impairment, and from Hepatology by Zhao et al., that's Zhao with an X, X-I-A-O, a molecular biologic analysis of cells that take in the inflammatory, fibrotic, and proliferative processes of extrahepatic biliary triagen. Integrative single-cell and spatial transcriptomic analyses identify a pathogenic cholangiocyte niche and TNFRSF12A as therapeutic target for biliary atresia. Jake, over to you. Let's start with the JPGN article.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, I thought this was an interesting paper that highlights this group of individuals with, they've defined as severe neurological impairment, SNI, who have ended up on home PN for a non-primary GI diagnosis. And this comes from the Toronto group, which is one of the world leaders in intestinal rehabilitation. And I thought it was just an interesting description of this group who many of us may not characteristically think as being candidates or the typical candidates to end up on home PN.
Typical candidates to end up on home PN usually have a primary gastrointestinal disorder, do they not?
Absolutely. And the biggest group of those would be those with either short bowel syndrome or one of its etiologies, or a dysmotility disorder that leads to classical intestinal failure, a failure to grow or sustain suitable growth with exclusively enteral nutrition, and therefore needing at least partial supplementation with parenteral nutrition. But this group is individuals without a primary GI diagnosis, and they cite it as multifactorial indications for initiation of PN, combination of pain with enteral feeds, suboptimal weight gain, increased losses, so diarrhea or vomiting, with a bit of dysmotility and other problems with multiple feeding tubes as well.
You're sure we're all familiar?
I'm sure we're all familiar with these kinds of patients in our general pediatrics practice. And I just thought it was an interesting to group together the 18 or so who've all ended up on a home PN program.
How are these patients who have these problems treated without home PN?
Without home PN, many of them will achieve growth, but it may be that they have suboptimal growth and they have a catalogue of unpleasant GI symptoms. In many cases, the patients struggle to clearly articulate their GI symptoms, and it can be very distressing for patients, for families, for their physicians. But I think that, or at least in my experience, in many cases, we wouldn't think to initiate home PN except in the most absolute extreme circumstances. And that's probably what was the case here.
The most absolutely extreme circumstances then would be very severe problems related to, well, I can't really say what they're related to, this severe neurological impairment. How did the children who were subjected to home, sorry about that, maybe not subjected, who benefited from home PN differ between GI problems and neurologic problems, the two cohorts.
So they, as you would sort of expect, the ones who had PN initiated for a neurological diagnosis were generally older, whereas those who had PN initiated for a non-neurological diagnosis, primary GI indication, were essentially all or nearly all infants with short bowel syndrome, where I think the mean age in the neurological group was nearer 5 years old. But after that, the kind of main take-home message really from this paper is that there is no major difference beyond that in terms of complications whilst on PN. Now, the individuals who had PN initiated for a GI diagnosis were much more likely to come off PN because they achieved enteral autonomy, which in many cases would be the goal. But that didn't happen so often in the individuals with neurological impairment.
What about complications? Was there any difference in the rate of complications or the sort of complications associated with PN between the two cohorts?
No, they don't describe any substantial or certainly no statistical difference in the rate of complications such as line infections, gallstones, and needing to be admitted. Obviously, many of these patients with severe neurological impairment have recurrent respiratory infections and may need lots of attendances and A&E, and they demonstrate that when they went on to PN, there was no further increase in their need to be admitted to the A&E department. One difference that is not statistically different, but I think it is worth highlighting, is that across the 13 years of this retrospective study, the all-cause mortality for patients with a GI diagnosis on home PN was 9%, but was 22% for those with neurological impairment. Now, that the p-value suggests that that is not different. I think that it still is worth noting that 22% mortality is quite high. Are talking about a fragile group of patients.
Has this emboldened you to offer home PN? Do you think that this will embolden others to offer home PN to patients with neurologic disorders?
I think that it will highlight it as a potential therapeutic option and demonstrate that neurological impairment should, of course, not be an absolute contraindication. And the evidence suggests that there is no reason why patients should not go on to home PN for it. I think that, as in many things in life, you do have to be aware that you're choosing one set of problems for another set of problems. The families are struggling with tubes and GI dystonia and perhaps vomiting with enteral feeds. But then they move on to home PN, and then their life will evolve around aseptic procedures and having provision of the PN and worry about line infections. So I think that provided that you can have those discussions and everyone is on board with what it is you're signing up to, I think that it is a useful case to highlight that this is a treatment option for this group of patients.
Is there anything else about the article that caught your eye that you'd like to bring to our attention?
I mean, this is a sort of minor point, but just in terms of interpreting some of the data of the absolute rates of events, in some places they've expressed them as clearly this is the number of events in 1 year post-home PN. That's straightforward to interpret. But for example, in the data interpreting the all-cause mortality and achieving enteral autonomy, we don't have a median follow-up duration. So, because obviously I have a 13-year retrospective study and they've shown that home PN has gone up. They haven't said exactly how long each patient was followed up for. So it's hard to know, hard to truly interpret those data.
So the severe neurological impairment then doesn't increase the risk of treatment with home parenteral nutrition. But then again, they don't do particularly better than the cohort of comparison children with primary gastrointestinal disease. I suppose that's a comforting conclusion.
Absolutely.
Now let's move on to the hepatology article. TNFRSF12A. Oof. A tumor necrosis factor receptor, superfamily member 12A. Blockade or knockout of TNFRSF12A ablates the usual changes in portal tracts of a mouse model of biliary atresia, suggesting an approach to therapy. This paper, with its listing of integrative single-cell and spatial transcriptomic analyses and the various procedures gone through in order to achieve those analyses, I find, frankly, daunting. I think we're lucky to have you here to say, how did they do it, and what does it all mean?
I will give it my very best shot at trying to interpret the importance of this paper. I think the starting out premise is that whilst at a kind of big picture level, we sort of understand what happens in biliary atresia, that there is obliteration and fibrosis of the extrahepatic biliary tree, and then an intrahepatic reaction to that. And part of that is described as the ductular reaction, this proliferation of cholangiocytes, often associated with fibroblasts and many other immune cells. And then over time, despite at least partial restoration of bile flow, the majority of patients do have progression of their inflammation and fibrosis in a very variable sense. But unlike many other conditions, and certainly adult liver diseases, at a molecular level, there is still relatively limited understanding of the exact signaling pathways between the various cells that are involved around the time that the Kasai procedure is done. And this paper is broadly taking an initially an unbiased, hypothesis-free approach to see what is going on, and then to try and zoom in on one specific gene that they think is important and highlight why and how.
Well, let's talk about an assumption here, which is that after the Kasai hepatic portoenterostomy restores continuity of biliary flow, that things should get better upstream, that it's all a matter of obstruction. It seems to me quite possible that the bile ducts within the liver are suffering from some sort of similar problem, at least in some instances of extrahepatic biliary atresia, and that it simply takes a little bit longer for that to manifest. In this regard, the human cohorts that they studied were liver at the margins of hepatoblastoma resection, liver at the margins of colidocal cyst resection, and liver taken at biopsy during hepatic portoenterostomy. That's the biliary atresia cohort. I'm not sure that the normal liver trimmed away from hepatoblastoma is a useful control. I'm not sure that the liver trimmed away at colidocal cyst resection or a biopsy taken from the periphery at colidocal cyst resection, particularly colidocal cyst resection without cholestasis, is an appropriate control for extrahepatic biliary atresia. Do you have thoughts on that?
It is something I've thought a lot about and is one of the things that I'm working on very actively at the moment, is that what is an appropriate control. And there is certainly, I think, no perfect control that we have tissue for, is, I think, the straightforward answer, because we don't get fresh liver samples from healthy pediatric livers, between 1 and 3 months old. So there is a school of thought that you take the most normal liver, it's in a non-cholestatic liver sample in an infant, and for which this seems to be the option they've gone for. Clearly, a hepatoblastoma will have been exposed to chemotherapy, a cholecystectomy, or cyst. We already know that there is a lesion in the biliary tract. So does that mean that the cholangiocytes are completely normal? Probably not. An alternative school of thought is to take a cholestatic control samples from a non-biliary tracheal diagnosis, such as biopsies in patients who then turn out to have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency or progressive familial intrahepatic cholestasis, which I think has its own problems.
Well, Jake, let's just talk about that in terms of the animal model in which they confirmed that having identified TNFRSF12A as important in the cholangiocytes, they studied individual cells' mRNA makeup, didn't they? And they found out that among these proliferating cholangiocytes in something called the cholangiocyte niche, TNFRSF12A was an importantly upregulated molecule. Have I got that right?
Yeah, so they broadly did things in three steps. They first did what is true single-cell RNA sequencing, where you take a chunk of liver tissue, physically separate it out into individual cells, and then are able to sequence the RNA within each cell. And that then lets you computationally separate out the cells and see what the RNA is in each cell. But that doesn't tell you where the cells are because you've already split them up. So then they did a technique called stereo-seq, which is a form of spatial transcriptomics, which allows you to look at lots of different RNAs with an intact piece of tissue. Now, the technique they've done, if you look at the paper, there's lots of little circles over the tissue as they've drawn it on. And that's broadly the technique they have measures little chunks of tissue. So it doesn't get down to the individual cell level. It just tells you about what's happening in little areas, which will, of course, be composed of multiple cell types.
Right, right.
And unsurprisingly, they demonstrate that there is the Duchenne reaction and an expanded proliferative cholangiocyte population in biliary atresia. And then kind of combining those two, they then looked at, well, the cholangiocytes are very important, and we know that they physically connect to fibroblasts and some macrophages. And then there are some other computational programs that allow you to predict what are the molecules that are communicating between the cells. And that's using that, they then popped out with TNFRSF12A.
As more important in biliary atresia than in the other two conditions.
As an upregulated signaling regulator between these cell types. And then the mouse model is, they used, it's a rotavirus mouse model, which if you inject a kind of newborn pup, a mouse pup with rotavirus, then, they get damage to the extrahepatic biliary tree. They get very sick and they almost all die within 2 weeks.
Jake, I wonder whether this importance of TNFRSF12A is not so much a matter of biliary atresia as it is of mechanical obstruction. Let me postulate that their controls, the cholecystectomy cyst patients, the hepatoblastoma patients, will, for the most part, not have been between 1 and 3 months old. They will have been relatively older patients, and hepatic ontogeny will have been at a different stage. With that in mind, then you could take a look at the reovirus model and say, all right, it works with this particular form of infection, but let's take an older mouse and ligate the common bile duct and then examine how that responds and whether TNFRSF12A is important and simple mechanical obstruction. Maybe that would have been a way to subtract out the effects of mechanical obstruction from the effects of whatever is going on in extrahepatic biliary attrition. Does that strike you as reasonable?
Absolutely. And I think the two are in both interesting questions. What is unique to biliary atresia and is going on in the liver away from the hilum? And what is merely a manifestation of extrahepatic large bile duct obstruction?
Well, they didn't do that particular set of experiments. All right. So the idea being that now that we know that TNFR-SF12A is an important signaling molecule, now it may be possible to administer agents that block that particular receptor, block that particular signaling pathway, and that might slow, or that might, and best slow, or in with best results, eliminate the fibroinflammatory reaction of extrahepatic biliary atresia. Is that part of the take-home message?
That is the theory. I think that, as with many things in life, it's probably a bit more complicated than that, because in previous genes that people have identified to be important like this, in different mouse models, if you knock it out, you find that actually the animals can do worse if you use a different animal model, because it could be that this gene is important in facilitating the formation of new biliary ductules, which actually supports a degree of bile drainage. And the rotavirus model is a very acute model. So I think that clearly there's more work to be done, but it is it's a helpful piece of work that gives the foundation for moving forwards.
Well, thank you very much. With that comment, I'm afraid that we've run out of time. Jake, once again, nice to have a chance to chat with you, and thank you for being our guide through these two articles.
Thanks, Alex.